crime fantasy author J.H. Fleming.
And I'm science fiction and fantasy author Philip Dreyer Duncan. And we have a very special guest this evening. I already can't talk. This is going to be a disaster. Oh my gosh, this is the worst I've ever done introducing a guest. Stacy, what have you done to us?
You know what? Made me extra fun.
I'm on like the sixth try of introducing our guest tonight, and I keep failing. So I'm going to let her introduce herself. Stacy, welcome to the podcast. Who are you?
Putting me on the spot like that. my name is Stacy Condla. I am a literary agent with The Rights Factory, and I have been agenting for 6 years now. Prior to agenting, I worked for Scholastic Book Fairs as a field representative. I managed at two different Chapters Indigo stores, which are big box bookstores, kind of like Barnes & Noble up in Canada. And I also was on the organizing committee of When Words Collide, which is a conference for readers and writers here in Calgary, Alberta. I did that for about 10 years. So my world has been all books all the time, and I love it.
That does sound lovely. Welcome to our podcast, and sorry I'm such a terrible introducer. I don't know if that's the right terminology. So you've been agenting for 6 years now. What led you that direction? Was that something you kind of always wanted to do, or?
That's a good question, and it has what I hope is an interesting answer. So I obviously was working in the book world for quite a long time. I was with Scholastic for about 10 years. I was with Chapters Indigo for just over 4. And then 1 year, in 2016, December, I ended up having a stroke, which was not a lot of fun. And it was kind of a weird stroke because it wasn't due to like pre-existing health conditions. It's because I had a terrible cold and I coughed so hard that I ruptured the internal lining of my carotid artery, and that blocked.
Oh my gosh.
Ended up clotting up and blocking the blood to my brain, and I had like this terrible stroke. So I was in the right place at the right time. I hit the floor in the emergency waiting room at the Foothills Hospital, and as luck would have it, the Foothills Hospital has one of the best stroke teams in the world.
Wow.
I know. And so I got the help that I needed quickly. I ended up requiring emergency angioplasty to have the clot removed from my carotid artery and then to have a stent placed in my artery to seal the rupture. So obviously, that event scrambled my brains. Like, you lose a lot of brain cells when you have a stroke, right? Mm-hmm. And it was in the stroke affected my left brain, which is my language center. I did lose the ability to speak when I was having the stroke, and it was pretty surreal afterwards, recovering, right? And to this day, I still will sometimes grasp for words, but I have a huge vocabulary, so I'm usually able to slot something in that works. But that was a major life event, right?
Yeah.
And it was an eye opener, right? And it made me ask myself, like, what do I want out of the rest of my life, right?
So sure.
When that happened, I was 46, and you know, I thought that I was just going to be, you know, doing, you know, probably retail management or whatever for the rest of my life, right? Mm-hmm. So anyways, I was recovering and working really hard to regain my reading speed and just working on some of the deficits caused by the stroke. And 9 months later, it was When Words Collide, time for the conference that I was a part of, right? Mm-hmm. And I was really excited to go. Because I was feeling a lot better, still not totally normal, but a lot better. And I met Sam Hyatt there, who owns the Rights Factory, and we hit it off. He is hilarious, and he's just a really great person. And we ended up having lunch after the conference, and I said, you know, Sam, I think what you do is really, really cool. I think I would like to try being an agent. It would probably level up my bookselling skills. And he said to me, are you sure you don't want to pitch me? I was like, yeah, no, I really truly think that I want to try being an agent. And he was like, okay, that's like super weird, but you know, we can try a few things. Why don't we start you out with doing some reading for the agency? And you can take a couple of these editing courses that I insist all of my agents take, right? And I was like, okay, let's do this. So the week after the conference, I'm at my neurologist and I'm telling him, you know, I think I'm going to take some university level editing courses. Is that okay? And he was like, go for it. See what happens, right? So I did it. And basically, like 6 months after the conference, Sam launched me as an agent. So I was launched as an agent in 2018. And here we are. So it was, long story short, it was a major health event that was an eye-opener and made me decide to chase my dreams.
You know, I always ask people to give us their villain origin story. And that might have been the best one we've gotten so far. That was amazing. I was like, when you started talking about the stroke, I was like, okay, this is fascinating. And obviously I didn't know this about you, but I was also like, did she not hear the question? I was like, oh no, I think she might have misheard me and I don't know what question she's answering, but that was amazing.
Sometimes I can ramble, but I do get to the point.
I mean, anyone who listens to us knows that I am very guilty of rambling. Yes. And they don't even know how bad it is because I cut myself down sometimes. So hey, don't support
you're
that.
You're speaking truth.
You're supposed to be like, you don't ramble.
No, you're speaking 100% truth. So yeah.
JH is still just mad that I told everyone her real name is Jamiroquai Hobbiton III.
No.
Well, so you stuck with being an agent for a while. You must enjoy it.
I really do. I get a lot out of the job. I think that if you work in the book world long enough, one of the key things that you recognize is the ability books have to mm-hmm. change people's lives, right? Mm-hmm. And we've all experienced it if we're readers as well, right? Like we all mm-hmm. have those key books in our past that we have read that have been pivotal or life-changing in some fashion, right? Mm-hmm. So being an agent, I get to help authors achieve their dreams or parts of their dreams, hopefully, right? So that's a mm-hmm. feel-good thing. And then because I'm helping them achieve their dreams and get their books out into the world, I'm also like indirectly able to help all sorts of random people all over the place that read these books, right? So to me, it's such a feel-good job. There's like mm-hmm. nothing bad about it. And it is giving back to the world. So
I could see, like, I think some of the appeal for me would be in the, like, can I finding ones that just are going to do really well. And not even just because that would be how I would make my living, but because I think that would be mm-hmm. thrilling, right? To read someone's work, look at their work, look at them and be like, I think this might be a winner. I'm going to go for it and then have it, you know, work out. Seems like that would be exhilarating.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna lie, doing, you know, big six-figure deals is an absolute thrill. I wish I could do one every week.
You and me both.
That doesn't happen. So mm-hmm. I'm still proud of like every book, regardless of the size of the deal, right? And proud mm-hmm. of every client that I work with. And you know, whether the book is a runaway sales success or not, it is a win, right? And it's a win for the author. It's a win for me. It's a win for whoever reads those books.
I mean, yeah, that's a very exciting, that would be a very exciting job to have. I've thought about it a few times like that. As far as for me, like if I was going to be in this industry and I wasn't just going to be an author, the agent route sounds like it'd be the most fun. Like that would be more fun than being a publisher or editor or anything else. Like, I think, I don't know, I think it'd be fun.
It is. It's just, besides being fun, it is also like a boatload of work, right? And so I'm sure you've heard like agents before talk about how overworked they are. And that actually can be a real thing, right? Because we don't have a regular paycheck.
Right.
We work on commission, right? So if we're not like hustling and selling books and doing all the work, nobody's mm-hmm. going to do it for us and we're mm-hmm. not going to get paid anything, right? So it does feel like we are definitely fighting the good fight.
I was going to add to that. I got to see a little bit of that side of it because I back in October, I became a assistant to a literary agent. She mostly does comics, children's books, graphic novels, that sort of thing. But just getting to see that other side of it, I've told Phil many times, I've had many what I call day jobs, like anything that's not writing is basically a day job to me. This is the only one I've had that's like, I'll quit everything else to write full time. I'm keeping this one because I absolutely love it. So I'm definitely in agreement with him that route is the most appealing. Though I would say I'm liking like just being the assistant because then like I feel like that's one step back where I don't have as much of the pressure that my employer has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But also as a writer, you're probably able to learn a lot and see writing projects in a different way than you did before working for an agent, right? Because we are looking at projects through a slightly different lens than the average reader, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Probably different than the average reader and the average author as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess your vision of it would be more closely aligned with like the editor at a house that would be interested in buying it, like an acquisitions editor, right? But generally speaking, your lens is going to be very different from everyone else's because it's more than just like, oh, I love this story and I think it's great, but it's also, is this commercially viable? Do I know the right person at the right house that I think would be interested in buying it because it would match what they do? Do I think this editor would pair up well with the author and all those sorts of things, right?
Yeah. And I mean, ultimately, it is like seeing a market for the book, right? And there are a lot of incredibly well-written books out there. But if they don't have a market that will actually buy them, that's going to be a pretty hard sell, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because I mean, at the end of the day, you're a business person, right? And you have to be able to sell the book and make money. And if you can't, you're not going to do the author any service anyway, right?
Exactly. That being said, though, I do think that we are guilty of taking on passion projects too every now and then. Right? How can we not? How can we not? We love books. We love reading. Right?
No, I think that's totally fair. I mean, why wouldn't you? Right? I mean, I could see where you're like, I love this story, and I really like the author. I mean, it might be harder for like cold queries coming in, but like if you've met the author and you're like, I love this person, I love their story, I think they're great. I don't know if this is completely commercially viable, but you know, maybe they've been trying for a while or something and you're like, I'm going to try to do something with this. I can see it.
Exactly. Or you just, you know, you read a book and you know in your heart that this book has a super niche market and it's going to be a hard sell, but it resonates so strongly, you want to try anyways, right?
Sure.
So that doesn't happen a lot, though, because if we just did those passion projects, we'd probably all be starving agents.
So do you do open periods? Is that how?
So I have been closed to queries for a while and I'm not planning on opening up anytime soon because my client list is pretty large. So I feel like I'm in a good place right now with my client list and I don't want to stack myself up any further, right? That could be very difficult. But at the same time, like every other agent in the world, I also have a serious case of FOMO and I don't want to miss out on like the next most awesome project.
Gonna put another dollar in that slot machine.
Right. But because of that, I do take queries and pitches at conferences, right? Because that's a slightly different dynamic than taking queries through Query Manager or my inbox, right? Mm-hmm. At least when I'm doing them through conferences, I have a chance to actually meet the authors behind the pitches and, you know, get a sense of personality and would we be a good fit? And that just gives me more information to make my decisions once I have their writing samples in hand, right? So
yeah,
I do still love taking queries in person, but for now I'm just not opening up my query manager for a while yet. you know, I will again down the road, but just not right now.
Well, what I was going to ask was, I guess what I was curious about is when you do have open periods and kind of like how long would they normally be open? And just what I really wanted to know, here's what I really want to know. How many manuscripts do you get to look at that just come out of the wild?
So when I first started as an agent, I was probably getting like 100 to 150 queries like a week.
Oh.
It was a lot and it was overwhelming.
Yeah, because you can't even read all of those.
Right. Now that I'm a more established agent and I kind of have my areas of expertise, that the queries are less, but they still can be, you know, 30 or 40 a week. Right. And if you're spending 10 minutes on each query, that adds up to a lot of time.
Right.
Right. And I mean, we need to read the queries so we can find really awesome talent. But when you have a full client list and you have all your client work that needs to take priority, queries slip to the bottom of the pile. And that's why it takes agents so long to respond sometimes, right? We just have a lot of work and it can be challenging to get to them all, right? We try.
Yeah, no. I couldn't imagine, right? Like, and I've thought about that. It's like you have all the stuff you need to do every day, but then there's just a constant inflow of, and let's be real, most of the ones that are coming in probably aren't a super fun read.
There is a variety of skill levels that come in through queries, right? There are. There are a lot of authors that are still just far too green. Their writing is not the level it needs to be to get an agent. Sometimes I will try to give personalized feedback, but quite often I just can't, right? Mm-hmm. So, I think that if there's any advice out there for aspiring authors is, you know, just make sure that your work is as tight and as perfect as possible before you query an agent. Because, yeah, we do drown in stuff that's just not ready. It's not ready. It's not that it's awful or bad or that the writers are talentless, right? It's just that they're not there yet. They haven't put in enough work. Their skill level hasn't developed enough yet, right? So
I left a pause there for a reason. I want to ask you a question and you can, one, totally not answer it, but also, two, tell me if you don't want it in the podcast. This is something I've been wondering forever. And you don't even have to speak to just yourself, but how many authors get picked up cold from queries versus ones that agents meet at like conventions and things?
I think that's a great question, actually. And I think that a lot of authors do get signed through Query Manager or querying through the inbox. I have probably more than half of my client list I have signed from cold queries.
Oh, wow. Cool. Very cool.
Obviously, in recent years, because I'm doing mostly queries at conferences, there are people that I have now met, right, that I'm starting to sign. And I'm also at that point in my career where I have such incredible clients who also know other incredible authors. So taking referrals from my clients is also a really valuable and wonderful and special way to sign new clients as well.
I've always wondered about that because I know obviously a lot of people are querying cold, but then you always, like the stories you always hear about, you know, referrals or somebody being met and it's like, I don't know anyone personally who got picked up from a cold query. So I was just kind of curious about that.
It does happen. I have done it. A good book is a good book. Right. And yeah. I mean, ultimately, that's also how editors acquire, right?
Sure.
I mean, I have sold projects to editors I have never met face to face.
Nice.
They're wanting the books, right? A really great book is what we're all after.
This might be a silly question because I remember an agent, I don't remember who he was, but I thought it was one of the greatest statements ever. And I've used it many times in my career since my day job. But we were at a WorldCon many years ago and somebody stuck up, and it was in the United States, and somebody stuck up their hand and they're like, why would I want an agent that's in England? Cause that's where this agent was based. And his response was because the world is global. Meaning that we live in an age of technology, but do you find it challenging being based in Calgary when, you know, a lot of the publishers and editors are in New York?
I don't. And I mean, I started as an agent before the pandemic, which was great, right? And I did a lot of legwork just through emails and phone meetings with editors pre-pandemic. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until the pandemic started, I think, that people started having mm-hmm. video calls more seriously, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So the pandemic ended up becoming sort of a great equalizer for all of us agents that do not live in New York City, right, or LA, because we can have mm-hmm. meetings like this through Zoom or Google sure. Meets or whatever. So it has not been detrimental at all. I have done a trip to New York and met editors when I was there before the pandemic. I went to the last Book Expo and met a lot of wonderful editors, and it was great. And I also have been to Toronto to meet editors there. It's sort of the publishing capital of Canada. Mm-hmm. I plan on going back to New York again, and I do plan on going back to Toronto again, but it's not totally necessary for people to live in those major centers anymore to do this job. We can do it literally mm-hmm. from anywhere with an internet connection.
Right. Yeah, I was going to just agree with what you were saying as far as from my own experience in the last few months, because my employer and I have never met face-to-face. She's in New Jersey, and it's always been through our meetings. And then I have helped set up several of her meetings, all of them through, the Google Meets and whatnot. So definitely seeing that side of it where it's just all this online stuff. So, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's awesome, right? We can do it. I feel like my time working for Scholastic Book Fair has helped prime me to do the legwork via the telephone mm-hmm. pre-pandemic, because I spent almost 2 years with Scholastic as an inside sales rep. So it was building relationships through the telephone, because we didn't even have like Zoom or Google Meets back then. So it's just, getting to know people, and we have the technology that enables us to do it even better now.
Yeah, because I wouldn't even have this job, 10, 20 years ago, because I would have to live in the same place, and that wouldn't be possible.
Yeah, but you would never even heard of it then, because you heard about it through social media, right?
It was actually Kevin J. Anderson posted it in Superstars, so that's how I heard about it.
Yeah.
That was awesome. Awesome.
Scholastic, I don't know what it is. I don't know exactly what they have, but they actually have a presence near us from a corporate standpoint or a factory standpoint. I'm not sure. There's a big Scholastic place just in like a town over from us. Two towns
over. It might be like a warehouse for book fairs.
It might be. I don't know. Here's what I know is I know a lot of people around here work for Scholastic, and I know every once in a while, like, I'll see their signs go up for need temp work, come to Scholastic.
There's lots of boxes of books that need to be packed.
I miss, what I really miss is being a kid and getting to go to the little kid mm-hmm. book fairs at my school. Like, I miss getting the pamphlet to take home and circle all the stuff. I don't know why they don't do that at day jobs, right? Like, find an office with a bunch of people, pass out the pamphlets, and like everybody can go home and circle what they want, tell their spouses, look what I'm going to get. And then, go in the next day and, turn in their pamphlets and order their stuff.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Scholastic has done an amazing job at getting kids excited about reading for a long time, right? And nobody can complain about that, because it's important for kids to find the joy in reading, right?
Sure.
It shouldn't be a chore.
Yeah. Last week we saw that we covered a news story that book clubs are on the rise from the millennial and Gen Z groups.
I believe it.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And like celebrity book clubs have been a huge thing recent years as well, right?
Yeah.
So and anything that encourages people to read, I think it's fabulous. I'm like, do it, have fun with it, enjoy, talk about things.
Yeah. Well, it seems like when smartphones and social media really started taking off, there was sort of a fear of like, this is going to be the end for reading. Nobody's going to want books anymore, blah, blah, blah. Ebooks are going to take over. And I mean, like, and everything just keeps like more people are reading now than were before,
I know. I remember when the ebook boom started happening, and there were all of these like doomsayers. Oh, dead, right? nobody's going to buy print books anymore. It's totally dead. And my whole response to that, even then, was video didn't kill the radio star. Okay. Like, there's room for both.
Yeah. Not only is print thriving, but now you have like this whole market of like special edition seems to be on the rise. Like limited edition books seems to be a big thing right now.
Yes. Because people love to collect the things that they love.
I get the Book Riot newsletters, and I'll just kind of glance through it at this point. I don't have time to look through them all. But anyway, I'll keep seeing ones where it's like a special edition of something. And like, I may already have a copy or two of it. And I'm like, ooh, that's really pretty. I love this new cover and I want to get it just for that. Like, right. I don't need another copy of this book.
Exactly. They'll have like new fancy cover art, or they'll have like color edges and, you know, like all the fanciness. Nice and ribbon bookmark.
Like the newest edition of Lord of the Rings came out recently and they'd include illustrations by Tolkien in them. So it's like, well, I have to get the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit and the Silmarillion because they did all of them with his illustrations in them. It's like, I already have three other copies of the Lord of the Rings, so I guess I'll get a fourth.
Right, but you need those ones.
Right, yes.
Yeah, in fairness, I'm not sure there's a version of the Lord of the Rings that comes out that we don't at least stop and look at the bookstore. If it doesn't come home with us, which normally it does, it seems like. Let's talk about parrots. That seems like a natural segue.
Yeah, what do you want to know about parrots?
How many parrots do you have?
I have 5 parrots.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, before I started working in the book world, I actually worked in a totally different industry, which was veterinary hospitals.
Nice.
I did several years working in vet clinics and participating in animal rescue groups and fostering and stuff like that. And I ended up getting involved with a parrot rescue because parrots, to me, are kind of extra special. They have scientifically been proven to have the cognitive function of a 5-year-old child. They are brilliant, okay? And because they are so brilliant and so high maintenance, a lot of them end up in bad circumstances because the people who have brought them into their homes just are not equipped to care for them properly, right? Mm-hmm. So you end up with a lot of very damaged and sometimes unhealthy parrots, right? So like one of the most common things that you see with parrots is people will get them and not understand how destructive they are and the fact that they need to be destructive and they need lots of toys to shred and chew and mutilate, right? So people will stop giving them toys to play with because, oh, they just destroy them all. It's too expensive, right? But they actually need that to, you know, have enrichment and stuff to do, right? Because otherwise it's like locking a 5-year-old child in the bathroom for 5 years with no toys. Mm-hmm. Like that child is going to come out of that bathroom psychologically damaged, right?
Yep.
I did not know I had so much in common with parrots. Cognitive function of a 5-year-old likes to have lots of toys to break.
Yes, exactly.
I might be part parrot.
So funny. So I ended up doing fostering for a parrot rescue and then turned into a dismal foster failure because I just fell in love with my fosters. And so I ended up with 5 in total. I have an Amazon parrot, an African gray parrot, 2 Eclectus parrots, and 1 Senegal parrot.
Wow.
And they all have their own very special needs and types of nutrition, and they all have their own preferences as to what kind of toys they like to play with and different activities they like to do, and they literally suck up hours of my day. I don't recommend parrots as pets. I feel like in a perfect world, parrots truly just would be living in the wild where they belong, right? Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, we have all these parrots that are already in captivity. So whatever I can do to give these 5 the best life that they possibly can have in these circumstances, I feel like I'm obligated to do that for them. Mm-hmm. And I get a lot back from them as well, because like cats and dogs, they are really loving with their people, and they are so smart and so funny and so interactive. They're just a joy, even when they're being too noisy and horrible.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
They say funny things sometimes too, mm-hmm. and they do associate meaning with things that they say. So like a lot of people, I think, have this misunderstanding that parrots just will mimic whatever you say, like stupidly, like they have no context, mm-hmm. right? But they do have context. So my African gray, he doesn't talk a lot because the other birds are noisier than he is, but he will say one thing, and he will say, "Do you want a treat, Griffy?" And that means he wants a treat, right? Because I've said that to him so many times, right? So he associates meaning with it.
Yes.
And then my parrot, Fred. Fred is hilarious. Fred, I'm her third owner. In her first home, she was named Fred because they thought she was a boy. In her second home, she laid an egg, so it was determined that Fred was not a boy. but Fred is Fred, and Fred calls herself a pretty boy, and I'm totally okay with it.
That's amazing.
She's hilarious. Yeah. And so when she wants to sit on my knee, she will say, "Come on. Come on," with like the question mark inflection at the end, right? So yeah, they're pretty amazing.
That's awesome.
I was going to say, I was just thinking while you were talking, one of our other author friends, she's an animal rehabilitator. Usually ends up with possums, but she has a sun conure. And like, nice. So she'll post on social media, like, you know, just the funny things her bird is up to that day. And I always, it's always hilarious, and I love it. But yeah, I was just thinking of that, yes, while you were talking.
they add a lot. Mm-hmm. They are comedians. They have moods, just like, mm-hmm. cats and dogs as well, right? They're really interesting.
Yep.
And then also when they're in a really bad mood, they're kind of dinosaurs. So like, watch out.
Well, yeah. So that's my limited experience with birds is when I was a kid. I grew up around Eureka Springs, Arkansas, which is kind of like this old eclectic Victorian tourist town. Right. And there was this old Victorian mansion, and the people who owned it turned it into like a sort of like bird sanctuary sort of thing. And so people would like go donate a few bucks, then you get to walk through this old mansion, but each room would have different types of birds in it. And my mom knew them from forever. And when they needed some help, she ended up going, and in the evening she would go over and like help clean up the mansion and take care of the birds and stuff. And I would get roped into it, but mostly that they would just, like, they loved her, but I would walk in and I don't remember if it was a parrot or a parakeet. It was a male, and it did not like males. And so if I walked into the room at the wrong time, if it was out, it would just chase me and try to peck the back of my head while I was running away.
I have fond memories of being chased by my grandparents' domestic geese out on their farm. So.
Yeah, pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. They are dinosaurs. They really are.
Unprompted, Stacy, tell us about your concerts.
So I used to go to concerts all the time in my teens and 20s. And
sure.
Then I stopped going to concerts because of, you know, having children and family, and life took over and got
stupid, boring adult stuff.
Right. I know. Awful. And then the pandemic happened, and there was no concerts anyways. Right. And then when things started opening up again and bands started announcing concert tours, I started thinking, this is something I would like to start doing again. And
yeah.
Over the course of the pandemic, I completely fell in love with the band Ghost. I'm like a total Ghost fan. I love them so much. So last January, they announced that they were going to be doing their re-imperator in North America. Okay. And I was like, I have to see Ghost. Like, this is like my mission this year is seeing Ghost, right? So as soon as the tickets went on sale, I ended up getting myself a ticket to see them in Salt Lake City because they weren't coming to Canada. Mm-hmm. And I know a few people in Salt Lake City now. And I thought, I'm just going to buy this ticket. It's January. I'm going to do this. So I'm like on Ticketmaster and I'm like sweating and stressed because I'm like, oh my God, what if I don't get a ticket? And so I did it. I got myself a VIP pit ticket. I'm like 52 years old at the time. And I'm like, I'm buying a pit ticket right on.
Love it. I love it.
And then I was like, I'll figure out how to get to Salt Lake City later.
Details.
Exactly. But after I bought that first ticket to see Ghost, I was like, okay, I should probably go do like a practice concert in the pit before Ghost to make sure I could actually handle this because it's been like decades, right? So Volbeat was coming through Calgary.
I love Volbeat.
I know. And they were so good. I was like right in the pit. It was a fantastic time. They put on a fabulous show. And
oh my gosh. I didn't even know they were still around. I hadn't heard a peep about them in years. I was just telling her about them, but a few weeks ago.
Yeah. So good. So anyways, I started just buying concert tickets and not even expensive ones, really, like because I live in a major center. There are enough really cool bands coming through with affordable tickets, you know, that are like between $30 to $60, right? So I'm not breaking the bank. And I ended up going to 18 different concerts last year
between
July and December.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing.
It's how I've decided to reclaim some personal time and not work. If I leave the house to go see a concert, I can't work, right?
I love
that. So just trying to find that work-life balance for myself. And so live music has become that way to have a little bit more balance and personal time for myself and just not think about work and just go have some fun and still support the arts community, right? Because, I mean, music, books,
absolutely,
art, whatever. It's, you know, the arts community, and I love it. So it's been awesome. But, yeah, Ghost totally lived up to all my expectations. They were super fabulous. And then the very next night at the same amphitheater in Salt Lake City, I got to see the Foo Fighters.
Oh, nice.
Nice.
Very nice.
I know. So that was awesome. And then this year, I already have gone to a few shows. I got to see Gwar for the first time, which was like a bucket list moment. It was the craziest show I've ever been to. And in total, I think I've got like 17 more concert tickets already bought.
Oh, wow.
That's amazing.
And I'm sure I'll buy more because why not? So, it's just a fabulous escape, and I love the music, and it's a blast.
That's amazing.
And I have some really good friends that I get to go with, nice, the shows with as well. But sometimes I'll just go to shows by myself, and I'm totally okay with that too, because that's also really fun. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought we did. I mean, we've slowed down a little bit, but I thought we did a lot of shows, but we have never done 18 in 6 months.
Nope.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I was going to say, so I don't know fabulous. That the Ren Faire counts.
The Ren Faire does not count. The Ren Faire is the Ren Faire. It is separate. It is a separate thing.
But it's work-life balance, right? Mm-hmm. You're going out to do something that's not work-related and just have fun, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Shut off the work brain.
Right.
That's awesome.
Yeah, the thing there is there's so many performers. You know, some of them are, you know, musicians. Some are, you know, there's acrobats and all sorts of other stuff. And so if you're going to multiple shows a day and then you're coming back every day it's open, it's like, I don't know. That might kind of count because we're going to all the shows.
We do have in the area we're in, we're close to Northwest Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for years down in Fayetteville, Arkansas, there was like a little concert venue. But now there's more popping up. So there's three or four smaller ones, and then there's a huge amphitheater pretty close by, where they actually bring in, you know, like they've had Foo Fighters there, for example. And
nice.
Oh gosh, who did we go watch there?
Josh Groban. I don't even remember now.
Yeah, Josh Groban.
Josh Groban.
I've seen him 3 times. Nice. He's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really cool when we saw him. So his opener was this lady, and I've forgotten her name, but she did like acoustic versions of like songs from Sweeney Todd, like all the Stephen Sondheim stuff. It was really cool.
I just went to a show on Saturday here in Calgary for a band called the Trans-Canada Highwaymen.
Nice.
And they are dubbed as like a super group because they are singer from previously from the Bare Naked Ladies, singer from The Pursuit of Happiness, singer from The Odds, and a singer from Sloan. So these are like 4 Canadian bands that are, you know, quite well known, especially in Canada, right? And they formed this new band called the Trans-Canada Highwaymen. And they've billed themselves as stars from the 80s and 90s singing your faves from the 60s and 70s.
I dig it. Oh, that's great. Fantastic.
So I was super excited to go see them because one of my favorite Canadian bands in the whole wide world is Sloan. I love Sloan. Sloan has been around since early 90s, and I bought their very first album on cassette. So I've been a huge Sloan fan for decades. And my partner jokingly said, as I was leaving the house to go to this show by myself, make sure you get a picture with the Sloan guy. And I was like, that is never going to happen, right? Like, no. And you know what happened? After the show, all of the singers came out to the merch table and did like a meet and greet. And I got a picture with the singer from Sloan.
Nice.
I
love it.
That's amazing.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah, yeah. It really made my Gen X heart really happy.
Oh, that is amazing. All right. Now that's going on our bucket list. We have to go to a concert with Stacey at some point. It's new.
Awesome. New Let's do it. Yes.
We'll find something somewhere in between or something near a convention we're all going to.
Sounds like a good plan. And be prepared to be in the pit because I like being up nice and close.
I'm game. Oh, that's cool. Okay, now let's do the news.
Okay.
All right. For our news this week, we picked mostly fun stories. And the first one I should have assigned to JH, but I'm a terrible human being, so I kept it all for myself. Ha, 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 ha. The never-ending story. Atreyu! It's getting another film adaption. Potentially multiple films. The Seesaw Films has secured rights to make more never-ending story films. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. So all I have to add is that I don't know if you've ever read the book, Phil, or Stacey.
I have not.
But the film that everyone's familiar with from the 80s actually only covers about half of the book. So there's a whole second half that we've never actually seen in a film adaptation.
Oh, cool.
So I am interested to see if they go that direction or, you know, what they do with it.
Yeah.
That is interesting. I did not know that. I have not read the book.
Yeah. It's been several years, but I remember getting halfway and I'm like, wait, what? There's also a whole half of a book left. What is this?
Yeah, you know, there's a part of me that's like really burnt out with like new versions of the same stories, but I kind of actually am excited about this one. I feel like it's been long enough that it could be fun to see a new version of it, you know?
Yeah, I have mixed emotions about it too, about just like remakes of older movies, especially like movies
everything
from the 80s, honestly. I know.
Yeah.
Right. Because the 80s were my formative years, right? Like I was a teen in the 80s. So I have a lot of nostalgia for the movies that were released in the 80s and that are now being remade like over and over, right? But then I had to like talk some sense into myself and go, okay, no, this is actually okay. Because in the book world, this sort of happens because like people are writing, you know, twisted fairy tales, right? Like, mm-hmm. have those not been done over and over and over, but people can still bring new elements, new twists, you know, take the stories in different and interesting directions with more modern sensibilities. So maybe that's not mm-hmm. a bad thing, right? Like, can somebody please remake The Breakfast Club so that it's not so rapey? That would be awesome. I would love that, yes. Right? And then there's also like fan fiction in the book world, right? Mm-hmm. And so like, I feel like sometimes Hollywood or like film producers remaking these older shows in the now is kind of like the book world equivalent of fan fiction, right? Like it's
right.
They're love letters to these works, right? So it's not a totally right. horrible thing. Yeah, that's just my take on it.
I always kind of give a little more leeway if it's a film that's based on a book and the book came first, because I always see like the book is the original and any film is then an adaptation of it. And so like, for example, like for The Lord of the Rings, which I've already mentioned on the show, and I'm sorry, I'm just going to keep bringing it up, but there were actually multiple cartoon adaptations before the Peter Jackson trilogy came out. And if we'd had that same reaction where it's like, oh, we already have an adaptation, we don't need another one, like we would have never gotten those really amazing adaptations. We would have just settled for the okay ones.
Yeah.
So I'm always open to at least see what a new movie does as far as like, you know, speaking back to the original, how they present it, if they're closer to the source material or if they do anything interesting with it.
Yeah, I'm pretty flexible to it. I think the only thing right now is I've noticed this trend, and JH, you and I were just talking about it the other day. I've noticed this trend recently, and I hope it's one that doesn't really continue. It seems like you're seeing more like when things get adapted, whether they're like repeats or like an adaption from a book to a movie or a game to a movie or something like that. There seems to be a thing right now where the creators are kind of, and I think they're doing it to create controversy so people will talk about it more, but there seems to be a push to be like, we are intentionally not going to do this for the fans. And then they kind of brag about it on social media and then they kind of aim it that way. And that to me, I don't know, that makes me feel icky about some of it. Like it's just a cash grab, you know, like Fallout, they're getting ready to do a Fallout TV series. And I think that was one of the, ooh, don't hold me to that. I may be wrong, but I feel like that was one of the ones where I saw the creators, producers, somebody involved with it were like, oh yeah, we're totally not trying to appease the Fallout fans. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, then why did you buy the IP? Why didn't you buy a different IP? You know, so it's, that's the only thing to me. So hopefully, like with Neverending Story, I'm hoping it's someone like us who grew up with it as a child and it's just like, oh my gosh, Neverending Story, I want to do my own version of it, you know?
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah.
Are either of you going to go see The Crow?
Ooh.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah,
I meant to show you the other day.
I know.
I don't know, Stacey. I watched the trailer and I don't know how I felt about it.
Right?
I don't know if I was excited or icked out.
I feel like that one is like, I don't know, it's kind of like a weird tempting of fate in some way. Because it almost feels like the original Crow was so special and so well received, but also so tragic because of what happened, right? It's like got its own curse attached to it, perhaps, you know? And so like redoing it to me just kind of felt in bad taste because of that, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, I feel that.
But then I was like, am I being too precious about it, right? I don't know. It's a tough one, but I'm not ready to commit to seeing it, so.
I think everything you just said is 100% how I felt about it. I think I'm 100% with you on that. I'm not sure.
Yep, it's a tough one.
Yeah, I don't know. That one was interesting for me because I actually saw it for the first time at a convention in Tulsa, and it had James O'Barr actually there, like talking about it and then like, you know, watching it with us, which was really interesting.
Yeah.
That is very cool.
Mm-hmm.
I do think they need to stop making Spider-Man though, over and over.
Yeah. I was like, so here's my problem with that one is, when they did it with Tom Holland, I was like exhausted with like, oh, here we go again, another bad Spider-Man. And then they finally did a good one. And I was like, oh, well, this is weird because you kind of burnt the storylines I would like to see with a good Spider-Man already. So you can't really do those.
Tobey Maguire was the Peter Parker. Okay.
Oh. Oh. Stacey.
I should have stopped with Toby. I was good with Toby.
Oh. Let's talk about library finds.
Oh no. Okay, well, to avoid a fight, apparently. Oh, gosh. So there's a public library in Massachusetts that's actually going to forgive their library fines for a month. And the only thing you have to do is submit a picture of a cat. And it doesn't have to be your own cat. It could even be a cat meme from the internet. But they're accepting cat pics instead of payment.
They're accepting cat pics as payment.
Yeah.
All I have to
say. That's pretty cool.
Is I wish that cat pictures were actually currency because I would be a gazillionaire. Make Jeff Bezos look like a pauper.
This is amazing. I think more libraries should do stuff like this.
Right.
I love it.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, I'm in multiple Discord groups, and, like, I feel like every single one has a pet channel, and it's always one of the most popular channels. There are always so many pictures of everyone's cats and dogs or whatever they have, and, yeah, I think that's a great idea because people do – that's one of the things I think most people can agree on is we want to see adorable pictures of your pets.
I almost wish that they could tie that in with – being like a fundraiser for the Humane Society or something, though. Yes, we're gonna forgive your fines if you show us your cat picture. But if you wanted to give your fine money to the Humane Society, that would be super cool.
Yeah, right? That is that a neat would idea. Be
cool. But it looks like they're actually doing some different things. Like they're having cat related events. So they're doing a DIY cat toys thing, cat eye makeup, Hello Kitty party, de-stress with cats from the Worcester Animal Rescue League, a cat's movie screening, after dinner craft, stained glass cat.
Have you watched the cat's movie? Because I have not, but I have heard things.
I have not.
I do want to call out the fine print at the bottom. It says, we will accept honorary cats as well, so you may show us a picture or a drawing of a dog, raccoon, orca, capybara, or any other animal. That's amazing.
This is amazing. Like, how cool of them to just roll with this. Like, I don't know whose idea. Yes. I mean, could you imagine, like, here's the thing. I could imagine being at my day job and being like, listen, I want to pitch this idea. We're going to forego everyone's fines by allowing them to pay us with cat pictures. My boss would be like, what? Do you need to go home? Is something wrong with you? You know? So I love this. I think it's amazing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like it.
If we could like avoid interest fees on loans by supplying kitty photos.
Yes. Let's make this a thing.
Oh my gosh, I got trapped the other day. I'm normally not somebody who gets stuck in like a random like doom scrolling. I stumbled on this video. I don't remember his name. Rockstar, something like that. He does voiceovers of people's pets. Like people will send him videos of their dogs and cats and stuff doing things. And he does voices, like voiceovers for the animals. It is so funny. Like I sent JH two of them. Like some of them nearly had me in tears. He does such a good job. I'll send you a couple of them, Stacey. They're so funny.
Sounds good. I'm into Unbelievable. Funny. I love funny.
All right. In our next news story, I have a giant ad on my screen. Oh, there it is. Reading newspapers is cool again, at least in England, apparently. I don't know what's happening with my British friends, but apparently a dating site survey of 2,000 Brits said that seeing someone reading a newspaper in public is sexy, as opposed to staring at their phone, which makes them less attractive.
I feel like that's a really small sample, like 2,000 people.
You don't think 2,000? Well, you got to think per capita. You got to think of how small it is and how many people. That's like all of Tennessee.
It's like a really small sample. I don't know. I don't know how much stock we can put into those research results, honestly.
I don't know, Stacey. I think it's legit. It's in the news and on the internet. It must be true.
It's also kind of judgy, though, right? Because, like, okay. So some dude is reading the newspaper. That's awesome. Doesn't necessarily mean he's intelligent. Okay, like,
right.
He may not even know how to read.
Right. but some dude could also be scrolling on his phone, and it doesn't necessarily mean he's scrolling through TikTok. Maybe he is reading an organic chemistry textbook. Like, you don't know, right?
Here's the thing. If you're making a snap judgment about a person based on whether they're holding a newspaper or a cell phone or a cat picture, I mean, that's weird anyway, right?
Well, I don't know. The cat picture is telling. That is a person I want to know.
Yeah, no, like if you're reading the newspaper and you're wearing like a Yoshi costume, that's pretty interesting.
I think they need to increase their sample size. Let's get some accurate data here.
Right.
I don't know 2,000 Brits, but I know like 20 I could probably ask. Hey, do you find people reading newspapers sexy? Just see what they say. I won't give them any context.
So random.
Oh, speaking of the UK.
Oh, yep. So according to the Publishers Association, this is based on research by Public First, the publishing sector in the UK is currently worth £11 billion, and they expect a 20% growth over the next decade.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually just saw in one of my email newsletters that BookNet in Canada did a recent study and said that the readers that they surveyed are visiting and purchasing more books and bookstores than in the previous year. So I think that BookNet is also forecasting growth in publishing for the next year.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I saw something and I didn't use it today because I couldn't find where they were citing the sources, and I don't like touting facts that I can't at least see a source for, but I guess I'm gonna do it anyway because I brought it up. But this article without any sources to cite said that, what was it? So book sales on the whole were up by 0.4% for 2023. Ebook sales were up 0.6%. And audio is up like a whopping 14 point something percent, which I buy. I mean, that's what we've been seeing, throughout the year. But it's kind of weird. Like, as we're pulling our news stuff together, I'll find a lot of different things about sales. And like one week it'll be like, everything's been up for the last 6 months. And the very next week it's like, everything's been down for 6 months. I'm like, well, you can't be both, you know? Something is, but on the whole, everything we see tends to indicate that book sales, whether paper, whether ebook, whether audiobook, are all up. They're all growing across all sectors, across the globe, and library usage has been going up as well. So it's all fantastic news, I think.
It is.
All right. And no AI stories today. Should we do the voice anyway?
Sure, go for it.
Right. In our continued coverage of our robot overlords. No stories. That's it. That was the news.
All Right, for our tool segment this time, we're going to talk about using read aloud functions in various softwares, Word, Scrivener, and whatnot. So, Stacey, I know you wanted to talk about this some.
Yeah, I wanted to mention it because I thought it was a really great tool that doesn't really cost much, because most authors out there, when they're writing, are probably using Word or Scrivener or something similar that has a read aloud function. And I think it might be a little bit of an underused tool. I like using it as an agent because I have to do so much reading and so much editing and so many emails that my eyeballs are bleeding, right? Painful. So I have started using the read aloud function to do first reads on client manuscripts, or like first reads on writing samples from queries, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. The AI narration is absolutely terrible, right? Like it pronounces words weirdly and it's, you know, doesn't have a lot of personality. But what I have found by using the read aloud function is that if the story captures me despite the terrible AI narration, we've got something good going on. Right? It's a very positive sign. So I like using it for that. And then I also like using it for final reads and proofing reads, because it really does help you catch errors that your eyeballs won't see, right? Because after you've read a manuscript a few times, if you're a writer and you're really, really close to your manuscript, even if you've put it in a drawer for a few weeks, you still are going to read what you think is there versus what is actually there. Mm-hmm. So the read aloud function can be so valuable in helping you catch typos, and particularly typos that, you know, things like Grammarly or whatnot won't catch either, because the word is actually spelled correctly, but it's not the right word, like you transpose something or whatever, right? So you need to be able to fix those things that the editing software won't catch either. So I just think that it's a really underused tool and possibly an underappreciated tool. And you get a lot of value out of that terrible AI narration.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've talked about it on here before as well. That's always my final draft before I send it to any agents or publishers. I have Scrivener read to me, and it is a horrible AI voice. It pronounces even regular words really oddly or just plain wrong. But almost every single time I'm catching things, there's like, oh, there's a word missing here that, you know, my brain just read right over it as if it was there, but the AI clearly did not say the word. And now I see, oh, it's not there. So I wouldn't have caught it otherwise.
Exactly. Yeah. It helps you catch those things that the editing tools just glaze right over. Right.
Right. Yeah. And normally Phil's looking over my stuff too. And sometimes I have beta readers and it's catching things none of us have noticed, is, you know, it's either missing or it was, you know, letters were transposed to make a different word or, you know, whatever the case was. So I'm definitely on board and fully endorse, like, yes, use this. It's definitely worth it.
Yep. I feel like maybe some authors are reluctant to do it because they don't really want to hear their own work read back to them. Like they feel like, oh my gosh, this is going to be so boring, right? To listen to my own book. I've already you know, written it and read it how many times, right? But it's a step that you want to go slow. You don't want to like speed up the voice, right? You want to just go slow and read with the voice and fix everything you catch as you go.
Right. I think what helps me as an author is I just consider it another editing draft. And so like, I'm going to be sitting here reading through this book anyway. Why not have my, you know, Scrivener robot read it aloud to me and help me catch these things my eyes are going to miss? Like, I'm going to be sitting here either way, going through it one more time. I may as well.
Exactly. And I feel like it also helps you to target words that are used too close together as well, right? Like if you have like a really, you know, interesting word, but you've used it like four times in the same paragraph, you're more likely to catch it if you hear it versus read it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, 100%.
I have nothing to contribute to this conversation. I haven't used it, but I'm going to though, now that I'm going to have a little bit more time to work on my writing, that is going to be something I start doing.
Yeah.
You'll have to keep us posted on how it goes.
Okay.
I want to know what you think. Like, how does it change your view of your own writing?
I dig it. Yeah, I'll let you know.
Right. I was going to add, I've encouraged him to do it so many times, but his thing was always his day job takes up so much time and he only has like so much brain power in the evenings. He's like, I just don't want to do it.
Yeah, it wasn't even just
like, you really should. Just it's amazing.
Don't want. It's like, I've got, you know, projects that take so much longer than they should. You know, even there's one, Stacey, that you're aware of that I, you know, a project I have, right? And I still have not been able to get that shipped off because I just haven't been able to get all the way back through it again, you know?
But it's all about taking the time that you need to do it well. It's not a race.
Which, by the way, I need to call out a big thank you to Stacey, who gave me some very, 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 very good advice. And I did exactly as she suggested. And the response I got was exactly what we would have hoped for, which was take all the time to make it perfect. So, yeah. So I got some extra time.
It's important.
Yeah.
I don't think that you can rush art of any media, right? Yeah. Whether it's writing or learning how to play a musical instrument or painting a masterpiece. Like, these things don't happen fast. They just don't.
Yep. Yeah. I think people try to force it and prove like, oh yeah, I can do it fast. But then the end result is not up to the quality it should be.
Yep. Yep.
All right. Well, the good news is I'll have some time to do this soon, which I'll talk about in the next segment. All right. For Creatives on Fire this week, I figured since we have an agent with us, we should probably take advantage of that. So, Stacey, do you want to give us some like do's and don't do's when approaching or querying an agent?
Do your research about the agents that you're querying. Don't just throw what you have at every agent listed in the phone book. Dated myself with that reference.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure anybody knows what a phone book is.
I know. But no, really, you're not helping yourself if you're not researching the agents that you're sending your work to, because every agent does not represent every single thing that an author writes. So make sure you're pitching your work to the agents that represent the kind of work that you are writing. That's really important. I have experienced getting things sent to me that I just don't represent, right? So it's wasting my time. It's wasting your time. We don't want to waste anybody's time. So that's a big one.
Okay.
Do be realistic in your pitches as well, right? Like one of the major don'ts is don't have like a huge ego in your pitch and say that your book is going to be like the next Pulitzer Prize winner or something like that, right?
But I thought everyone loved egotistical people.
And the same goes with, you know, using comparable titles. I think that comparable titles are crucial in your queries. Mm-hmm. You should include comparable titles. But don't pick like the blockbuster bestsellers as your comparable titles, because that's too lofty, right? You do need to be a little bit more realistic than that. And I think that for the most part, it's really nice to get comparables that are like a book meets a TV or film.
Oh, really? Right? That's interesting.
So you're allowed to mix media, because really what the comparables are all about is just showing the agent what the vibes of your book is.
Okay.
Right?
That's really good. I've never heard that before. That's super helpful.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever heard it, but I've definitely seen it in practice, both on social media and in other query examples. But
yeah, it works really, really well. And it's a nice way to get the point across of, you know, what sort of vibes your book has, what sort of a feel your writing is going to have.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that. What else? Do be concise. really, really long queries are not the best queries because, remember, our eyeballs are bleeding. So keep it short and sweet to the point. We just want to know what your book is about. We don't need to know every single plot element in the entire novel, and we don't need to be introduced to every single character in your novel, right? Like, just give us the down low quickly.
I feel like I would be a little bit of, I mean, this is probably just me being a corporate jerk. But I feel like if I were an agent and somebody sent me a very like long-winded and not well-written query letter, I'd be like, well, this is how you write emails. There's no way your book's good.
Yeah. And I mean, unfortunately your writing can be judged like that, right? When I am open to queries, quite often what I will do, and I'm kind of an anomaly, I think, I don't know a lot of agents that function like this, but when I'm open to queries, quite often I won't even read the query.
Oh, I like that.
I will just go straight to the sample pages and start reading the sample pages, because I just want to know if the writing is there, right? Like, is there something here? And then if the writing captures me, I can go back to the query, read the query, see what that's all about, see where the story might be going. And then I'll check out the author bio and see who this person is, right? So I feel like I'm able to give the samples maybe a more fair shake because I'm not passing based on the query, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's lovely.
But there are a lot of agents out there that do pass on the queries, yep. And that's fair because we have a lot of work to go through, right? So, you know, query writing is a skill, but you can't put all your eggs in the query letter basket, right? Because you can, conversely, you can write a killer query, right? Like a truly killer query that just blows my socks off. And then if I open the sample and the writing is not good, you're no further ahead, right?
Right.
The writing needs to be good.
Is there anything in that step that you get to where you know, you like the sample, you like the query letter, then you go to the, you know, social media stock? Is there anything that's like, I mean, besides the obvious things, is there anything that would be like an immediate red flag? Like, ooh, maybe not.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like if I check out an author on social media and they're complaining about publishing, we're probably not going to be a good fit, right?
Fair enough.
You shouldn't bite the hand that will potentially feed you, right? You have to love the industry or why are you doing this? So I think that complaining about publishing in general on social media should be a big no-no, and it is a major red flag for me. I don't want to work with people that are complainers on social media, right? Because it generally means that person probably complains about everything, sadly.
Yeah.
Right. And then like personally, I think that there can also be like personal red flags when we check people out on social media. Mm-hmm. Right. Like it's no secret that I am very much a left-leaning person that strongly, strongly believes in human rights. Mm-hmm. So if I like a writing sample and a query, and then I find out on social media that a person is, you know, radical right or misogynist, or, you know, that's not going to work either, right? So I think that you need to put your best foot forward on social media. Really?
I think that's fair.
Don't badmouth people. Yeah. So, and I mean, everybody has different bars, different levels that they want people to be at in order to work well with them, right? So it can also be very subjective, but those are kind of my turnoffs.
Fair enough. I've been a hiring manager for years now in all the various roles I've had, and I've never been one that used social media to look at potential hires, right? But it's the same thing, right? If I were to do that, and just in general, if I saw somebody being very negative, you know, rather complaining or just being rude or whatever, like, that's probably going to make me wonder, what are they going to be like to work with? And I would imagine it's the same thing for you, right?
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. But like I said, different people have different levels of tolerance for different behaviors, right?
Sure.
Ultimately, I think that when you're in the situation, you have a sample that you love. The query is really good. You're interested. Then the next step is going to be to schedule a chat, right? Either a video chat or a phone chat, and just start getting to know the person, right? And see what sort of vibes you get from each other, because it goes two ways. It's not just a one-way street, right? Like if I'm having a chat with you and you're getting bad vibes from me and you're thinking, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to work with Stacy's style, then you should listen to that, right? Because this is going to be a long-term relationship and you don't want to get into something that's not going to work well, right? So I think more important to me than a social media presence and what people are doing on social media is the vibe that I get from those meetings when I'm considering making an offer of representation.
That's probably fair.
Yeah, I was going to say, I did have one question. This is kind of something I've wondered, and so I figure I'll take advantage and ask someone who actually does this. So I've queried a bunch, and I have a massive Airtable database to keep track of, you know, all my various queries and whatnot. But one of the things I have is whether an agent has on like their website or query manager their timeline for getting back to, or if they want you to follow up after so long, or if you should wait so many months and then consider it a no. For the ones that don't have that, what would you say would be a good kind of standard, like wait this long and then either follow up or consider it a no?
Yeah, that's a tough one because, again, everybody is really different, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of guilty of being one of those people that doesn't have a timeline. Ultimately, I think that with agents, it can be either a very fast yes or a very fast no. And it's all the maybes that get hung up in limbo, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're hanging on and hanging on, that's actually kind of a good sign because that means you're not a fast no.
Right.
Right? Yep. Yeah, but there's something holding the agent back from saying a fast yes, right? Mm-hmm. So in those cases, a lot of times it can also be dependent on the agent's workload, right? Like they see something there, but they're not quite sure, and they've got all these other things going on. So it just kind of will sit there until they have time to revisit, right? And sometimes, honestly, sometimes I've revisited things multiple times before making a decision, right? I think it's safe to follow up. I think in the olden times, you know, 6 to 8 weeks would be a kind sort of time frame. These days, just given how tragically slow and backlogged we all are, honestly, I'd be grateful for 12 weeks, which sounds like long, but it's just reality, right? We have huge, huge workloads and queues of things to read through. But I don't think that a nudge is a bad thing, right? Especially if it's just like a really kind check-in, you know, hi, I'm just checking in. I haven't heard from you, you know, I know you're super busy.
Great.
And I actually did end up signing a client after sitting on her query for over a year.
Oh wow.
So that was related to my own bandwidth, right? Like I felt like there was something there. There was something I really liked, but I didn't have the bandwidth for many, many months. And then when I did, I was like, okay, I'm gonna like reach out to this author and see if she's found representation yet, right? And lucky me, she hadn't. So now we're working together.
Nice.
Right? So those sorts of things do happen as well, right? So don't think that, you know, just because it's been a year, it's an absolute no, because it might not be. And yeah. I mean, even on the agenting side, I have sold books that I've had out on submission for, you know, over 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So patience and persistence.
Right. Yeah, I was kind of curious about that because I'd been using my massive Airtable database, and my own kind of personal was like, okay, if it's been a year, I'm going to go ahead and just mark it as no response and, mm-hmm. you know, move on.
Yep.
But I started using Query Tracker back in December, and I'm still using my massive Airtable database because it tracks some stuff that I can't track otherwise. But it was interesting because Query Tracker has the ability to see other people who have queried, how long the query's been out and how long before they marked it as it's, you know, no response. And Query Tracker's own default is just 120 days. So I was kind of curious, like, how accurate that was, if some people mm-hmm. are leaving it open too long. Some of them are closing it after like a week, and I feel like that's way too short a time to consider it a no and move on. I just didn't know if there was like a average somewhere in there, but it seems like honestly
my personal rule of thumb as an agent when it comes to getting responses from editors is it's not a no until I get a no.
Mm.
Right.
It's fair.
Yeah, makes sense.
So yeah, I feel like agents all have their own sort of rules for following up and whatnot. Mm. But if there's no rules, I say do follow up. Don't be super pushy, obviously, but do follow up. And just remind yourself that we're not ignoring you because we want to be jerks. We just sometimes do not have the time to get back to the queries, right? And they just sink to the bottom of our to-do list until we have time, and we want to have that time, but it doesn't always happen, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not a no until it's a no from me.
That's great to hear.
All right, cool. I thought for the financial side, and I think we've gone a little long tonight, but that's okay. I'll just talk about a couple things real quick. So obviously I announced last week that I am preparing to transition to full-time. So by the time this airs, I will have one more week left at my day job, and then I will be moving to full-time. I made that official announcement to everyone today. That was super weird. Because throughout my professional career, I've kind of kept my writing career and professional career very separate. So there were a number of people in my department who didn't even know that I wrote. That was one side of the spectrum. To the other side of the spectrum of the handful of people who apparently had already figured out what my pen name was and knew all about me. so that was a mixed bag. There was kind of agreed surprise all around the room that I was leaving, but then there was surprise of like, wait, you do what? And then the other ones are like, oh yeah, he totally does that. You should read his bio. It's hilarious. so it's weird. I don't know why it's always been weird to me to cross those streams. I think that might just be a me thing. But that's fine. That's not really useful advice for anyone. That's just what happened to me. Whatever. One thing that's useful is obviously I'll be responsible for my own insurance. So at this juncture, I went the CIFWA route because JH and I became full-fledged members last November.
December.
Yeah, December.
December. Yeah.
So I reached out through the LIG contact that's provided to us through them. And that was a really painless experience. It took about all of 10 minutes, and I had some options available to me. And I will say that the options that came available to me were maybe better than I expected from an insurance standpoint. I still haven't got to the fine print, but what was presented was better than I might have expected. And it was considerably cheaper than I had budgeted for, and a little cheaper even than I had hoped for. Especially when I wrapped in the dental and vision. So that was pretty promising. That made me pretty happy. The one part that didn't make me super happy is I asked the rep for, you know, can you send me over the details so I can kind of go through them? And he sent me screenshots of what we'd already talked about. And so I went back and said, hey, like, I kind of wanted to get into the fine print here. I kind of want to know what the in-network versus out-of-network prescriptions, all, you know, all that kind of stuff. And he said, yeah, let me see what I can do, and hasn't gotten back to me, which I don't love that part. But it seems like a promising way to get that expensive self-employed insurance. And just to be clear, even though I said that it was better than I hoped, it is still going to be a hefty price tag every month. That will be my most expensive living expense. So yeah, that part's super fun. The other thing that I thought I would mention from a Creatives on Fire standpoint is, I'm sure there's questions and I might go into this a little deeper at some point, but from a financial standpoint, the way I have set this up is I have, in case you're wondering how I'm going to draw down, how I'm going to do all of this, I have 1 year of living expenses just in a savings account. And then I have a separate savings for emergencies and car emergencies and medical emergencies. I have all those separated out into different things. And I have just 1 year of runway expenses in a savings account. And then I have the next 2 to 3 years in a stock brokerage account is how I did it. And I think that's it for the moment, really. But as I learn new things through this transition, I will share them in this segment of the show. All right.
Exciting stuff.
It is. I'm still terrified. In case anybody is wondering, I'm still through the moon and also horrified. Horrified.
I empathize. I took the plunge into full-time agenting last fall. So letting go of the regular day job income was scary.
It's terrifying.
Yep.
It's like I've spent the last 20 years with somebody handing me a paycheck every 2 weeks. And now I keep trying to tell myself, like, your royalty checks come every month. It's sort of the same thing, dingus. But it's kind of not, too, right? It's kind of, I don't know. And as you said at the beginning with your job, right, it's like you're getting paid based on commissions and things. So it's not a regular schedule, right?
Exactly.
So,
mm-hmm.
You know, some of my royalties are regularly scheduled, but they're going to be different amounts every month, right?
Yep. Yep. Things are just no longer predictable for you.
Right. Well, it's predictable what I'm going to be eating, and that's rice and beans. All right, Stacy, tell the people where to find you.
You can find me on social media. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can also find me through the agency website, therightsfactory.com. And then also my best book friend in the entire world, Winston Pye. We've known each other since we were 17. He and I have a passion project website called butterfliesandaliens.com.
What is this?
I'm looking at
it right now.
Butterflies and Aliens Library of Literary Eccentricities and Rarities. We are super chuffed that the acronym for that is Baller.
That's amazing.
And it is a book blog of sorts where we do like written interviews with interesting bookish people. We feature books of the week. We just do random weird book stuff. It's all book centric and nerdy. So you can find us there as well.
Oh, this is wonderful.
That's awesome.
I love it. I didn't know about this. Now I do. Okay. JH?
You can find me at jhfleming.net. I am also on all the social media sites as JH Fleming. I always mention the social media sites, but I was thinking about this beforehand. I should probably be sending you guys more to my newsletter and Patreon and Ko-fi because I'm way more active on those than I am on any of the social media. So go find me there. I have some free content, some paid content. The newsletter is completely free. So sign up for that. And then you can find my band Wildwood Minstrels on all the music sites.
And you can find me probably taking a nap because I'm retired now. No, go buy my books. I need you to. I'll starve. I don't want to eat rice and beans. Philip Dreher Duncan, philipdreherduncan.com. And if you haven't gotten it yet, the latest Blade Mage book is out. It's called Rebel Medicine. All right, Stacy, thank you so much for being on our podcast.
Yes, thank you for having with me. It was fun. I think this is the funnest one I've done.
Oh,
good. That is the right thing to say. I approve of this. That is the idea. You heard it from Stacy. Funnest podcast ever in the world that ever existed. All right. Thanks, guys. Yeah.